the race for space, as it was soon called, we orbited our first satellite, Explorer, in early 58. Just before Nikita Khrushchev won the five-year power struggle following Stalin's death to become the new Russian premier. Now there was new activity in the Cold War. An attempt to squeeze us out of Berlin, a bluff which failed. And then a thaw, and another first, a visit to the United States. In September of 1959, Khrushchev timed another space achievement for the eve of his arrival. A Russian rocket hit the moon. We watched with curiosity the reactions of the volatile Russian. For instance, this incident in Los Angeles.
Сейчас мне подошли и сказали, нет, вы, говорит, в такой-то городок поехать не можете. Как называется он?
But just now, I was told that I couldn't go to Disneyland.
Я говорю, почему?
I asked, why not?
Может быть, там теперь ракетная площадка создана?
What is it? Do you have
по запуску ракет?
Rocket launching pads there?
Я не знаю, да.
I don't know.
After the coast-to-coast tour, Khrushchev and Eisenhower retired for a quiet 2 days at the president's mountain retreat, the famous Camp David meeting. They emerged smiling. Khrushchev even had a three-word farewell sentence in English.
Goodbye, good luck, friends.
But the U-2 incident, with U.S. pilot Gary Powers shot down over Russia, ended the spirit of Camp David, a planned summit meeting, and a return visit by Eisenhower. And there was trouble close at home. A bearded revolutionary, who finally upset Cuban dictator Batista, gradually revealed himself as a dictator and a Marxist. Here is how Fidel Castro reacted to American criticism.
We are not afraid to be submitted to the public opinion judge, because we are fulfilling our duty as patriot, as human, and as democratic men. And I want that the newsmen come to Cuba, that is the best way of proving that the United States does not know the truth. The best way to prove the truth is seeing.
Typically, few American newsmen got in, and those few were not permitted to see the truth. New excitement came to American political life in 1960, a presidential year. At the Democratic Convention in Los Angeles, once frontier land, nominee John F. Kennedy, in his acceptance speech, gave the title and theme of his campaign.
For the problems are not all solved, and the battles are not all won. And we stand today on the edge of a new frontier, the frontier of the 1960s, the frontier of unknown opportunities and perils, the frontier of unfilled hopes and unfilled threats.
His Republican opponent, Richard M. Nixon, was much better known to the voter. But this was quickly changed by television in a remarkable series of five TV debates. Here is the opening of the series, introduced by Howard K. Smith.
Good evening. The television and radio stations of the United States and their affiliated stations are proud to provide facilities for a discussion of issues in the current political campaign by the two major candidates for the presidency. The candidates need no introduction. The Republican candidate, Vice President Richard M. Nixon, and the Democratic candidate, Senator John F. Kennedy.
Mr. Smith, Mr. Nixon, in the election of 1860, Abraham Lincoln said the question was whether this nation could exist half slave or half free. In the election of 1960, and with the world around us, the question is whether the world will exist half slave or half free.
Mr. Smith, Senator Kennedy, the things that Senator Kennedy has said, many of us can agree with. There is no question but that we cannot discuss our internal affairs in the United States without recognizing that they have a tremendous bearing on our international position.
With TV in close to 90% of America's 50 million homes, it is unquestioned the debates were a significant factor in the outcome. Kennedy won by the slimmest of popular vote margins. The inaugural ceremonies had several innovations, a return to top hats, many of us could now see it in color TV, and the young president included an authentic American creative voice, Robert Frost. The venerable poet was bothered by the lights.
This tribute to be his that here I bring is about the new order of the ages. I can't see in this light.
His inaugural address sounded his keynote. In a difficult world, a renewal of citizen dedication.
I do not believe that any of us would exchange places with any other people or any other generation the energy, the faith, the devotion which we bring to this endeavor will light our country and all who serve it. And the glow from that fire can truly light the world. And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country. My fellow citizens of the world, ask not what America will do for you, but what together we can do for the freedom of man.
In his first months, Kennedy set up the Peace Corps and the Alliance for Progress to aid Latin America's economy. Then came bad breaks. An anti-Castro invasion of Cuba's Bay of Pigs was a fiasco. A wall dividing East and West Berlin was put up by Khrushchev, and only months after a meeting with Kennedy in Vienna, the West could only protest. And a great world citizen was lost, flying into the Congo, which he had helped defend from chaos with UN forces. Its Secretary General since 1953, when he took office with these words.
I, Dag Hammarskjöld, solemnly swear to exercise in all loyalty, discretion, and conscience the functions entrusted to me as Secretary General of the United Nations, to discharge those functions and regulate my conduct with the interests of the United Nations only in view.
Now came Kennedy's most testing hour and a crisis which had us looking into each other's faces with searching thoughts. October 62. Our U-2 planes spot secret atomic missile sites on Cuba and verify that the buildup is coming from Russia. Kennedy demands withdrawal. The buildup continues till an arc from Canada to the Panama Canal is under atomic threat. Khrushchev stalls, says the sites are defensive. October 22nd, Kennedy takes the air. His face tells us this is it.
Within the past week, unmistakable evidence has established the fact that a series of offensive missile sites is now in preparation on that imprisoned island. The purpose of these bases can be none other than to provide a nuclear strike capability against the Western Hemisphere. The 1930s taught us a clear lesson. Aggressive conduct, if allowed to go unchecked and unchallenged, ultimately leads to war. Acting, therefore, in the defense of our own security and of the entire Western Hemisphere, and under the authority entrusted to me by the Constitution, as endorsed by the resolution of the Congress, I have directed that the following initial steps be taken immediately. A strict quarantine on all offensive military equipment under shipment to Cuba is being initiated. All ships of any kind bound for Cuba, from whatever nation or port, where they're found to contain cargoes of offensive weapons, be turned back. It shall be the policy of this nation to regard any nuclear missile launched from Cuba against any nation in the Western Hemisphere as an attack by the Soviet Union on the United States, requiring a full retaliatory response upon the Soviet Union. I call upon Chairman Khrushchev to halt and eliminate this clandestine, reckless, and provocative threat to world peace.
Cold turkey, a true nuclear showdown, the first we had ever lived through. You could imagine these SAC-B-52s wheeling the air with their atom bombs, our ICBMs, and the Russians zeroed in. 6 days of tension. Then Khrushchev gave in, called back his ships, and the world sighed its relief. Around this time, we were hearing quite a bit about and from a young heavyweight who composed light verse, Cassius, nicknamed Gaseous Clay. His talk was windy indeed.
I am the greatest. You never know what I'm going to come up with. A movie star, a champ like me, just don't stop at one thing. You never know what you're going to hear when you tackle me.
But in 64, he took the title from Sonny Liston. In these early 60s, rock and roll really took command. The driving beat that got its first big circulation with Elvis Presley in 56. Here's a typical in-person bit from Teeny Lopez. The big tonight, Al Martino.
The memory of you, your touch and your kiss still lives in my heart.
But there was work to be done, space work. The Russians had put the first man in space, Major Yuri Gagarin, in April of 61. After our suborbital flights of Shepard and Grissom, we finally got a man up and around on February 20th, 1962, Lieutenant Colonel John H. Glenn, first American to orbit Earth. These words crackled down from his capsule.
Zero G, and I feel fine. Capsule is turning around. Oh, that view is tremendous. Roger, turnaround has started. Capsule turning around, and I could see the booster during turnaround just a couple of hundred yards behind me. It was beautiful.
In July, Telstar, a space relay station which gave us live transatlantic TV. Then in September 62, the president said,
"We choose to go to the moon in this decade."
That meant Project Apollo. Price tag, say, $10 billion. Why not? Fantastic TV pictures of rocket blastoffs were already a commonplace. But an old and deep problem in American life brought us constantly back to Earth, the Negro and civil rights. Since the Supreme Court school desegregation decision of 1954, there had been progress and inevitable disturbances. Army troops in Little Rock in 1957, bombings in Birmingham, home base of the Negro preacher who became the modern movement's philosopher and Nobel Prize-winning leader, Martin Luther King.
We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. Yeah. And if America is to be a great nation, this must become true. And so let freedom ring. And when we allow freedom ring, when we let it ring from every village and every hamlet, from every state and every city, we will be able to speed up that day when all of God's children, black men and white men, Jews and Gentiles, Protestants and Catholics, will be able to join hands and sing in the words of the old Negro spiritual, "Free at last, free at last. Thank God Almighty, we are free at last."
The drive was difficult but unrelenting. To break segregation at the University of Mississippi and register its first Negro, James Meredith, took federal marshals, National Guard, and regular army troops, and tear gas. Three killed and scores injured. Here is Meredith shortly after, registered, attending classes.
I think I'm learning about as much as I ever did.
How do you characterize their attitude toward you here?
That's their problem, not mine.
Have you been able to concentrate on your classes, Mr. Meredith?
I'm not having any trouble concentrating.
The president sent his long-awaited civil rights bill to Congress in June of 1963. It would finally give the federal government power to intervene in cases of discrimination within a state. There would be the bitterest of opposition. In August, he had a deep satisfaction. A nuclear test ban treaty was signed by the United States, Britain, and the Soviet Union. Then, in November, the president and Mrs. Kennedy went to Texas, along with the vice president and his wife. The last leg of a three-day trip found the president's party in Fort Worth. At breakfast, there would be a presentation of a 10-gallon hat, then a short flight to Dallas, and a motorcade through that city to its trade mart for a luncheon speech. That was the program on Friday, November 22nd, 1963, for John F. Kennedy, age 46, 35th President of the United States.
2 years ago, I said that, introduced myself in Paris by saying that I was the man who had accompanied Mrs. Kennedy to Paris. I'm getting that same sensation as I travel around Texas. Nobody wonders what Lyndon and I wear. the White House on Monday. If you'll come up there, you'll have a chance to see it there.
The doors fly open, and the loading ladders are being wheeled into place. This is a split-second timed operation for the Secret Service and the Air Force and the Signal Corps. Nothing left to chance. Every possible precaution has been taken. The reception line is formed, and there is Mrs. Kennedy, the First Lady, stepping from the plane, wearing a bright pink suit with a dark fur collar and a matching pink hat, and the President, wearing a dark suit, steps off directly behind. The President's car is being delayed momentarily. We can't see from here exactly what is holding it up, but this is the moment where the Secret Service has its point of tension. As we have talked with many of these Secret Service men in the past few days who've arranged for the President's security, they say when the President stops moving, that's when we're concerned, because that is when the possibility of trouble comes to the forefront. And here comes the President now. In fact, he's not in his limousine. He's departed the limousine, and he is walking. He is reaching across the fence, shaking hands with many of the people who have come here to see him. He is closely accompanied by Dallas police officers and, of course, the Secret Service. And now the President and First Lady are retreating from the fence. They're heading now for the official limousine where Governor Connally stands, waiting their arrival so that they can make their way downtown and out to the Trade Mart. The party is now ready to depart Love Field. It will go Mockingbird Lane to Lemon Avenue, then travel south on Lemon to Turtle Creek, Cedar Springs, through the downtown area on Harwood to Main, west on Main to Houston, through the Triple Underpass.
The President's car is now turning onto Elm Street, and it will be only a matter of minutes before he arrives at the Trade Mart. I was on Stemmons Freeway earlier, and even the freeway was jam-packed with spectators waiting their chance to see the President as he made his way toward the Trade Mart. It appears as though something has happened in the motorcade route. Something, I repeat, has happened in the motorcade route. There's numerous people running up the hill alongside Elm Street, there by the Stemmons Freeway. Several police officers are rushing up the hill at this time. Stand by just a moment, please. Something has happened in the motorcade route. Stand by, please. Parkland Hospital, there has been a shooting. Parkland Hospital has been advised to stand by for a severe gunshot wound. We're here at the Trade Mart. The motorcade is coming by here. I can see many, many motorcycles coming by now, police motorcycles. Just heard a call on the radio for all units along Industrial to pick up the motorcade. Something has happened here. We understand there has been a shooting. The presidential car coming up now. We know it's the presidential car. You can see Mrs. Kennedy's pink suit. There's a Secret Service man, spread eagle, over the top of the car. We understand Governor and Mrs. Connally are in the car with President and Mrs. Kennedy. We can't see who has been hit, if anybody's been hit, but apparently something is wrong here. Something is terribly wrong.
I have just talked to Father Oscar Hubert of the Holy Trinity Catholic Church. He and another priest tell me that the pair of men have just administered the last rites of the Catholic Church to President Kennedy.
Ladies and gentlemen, we have a press report over the wires. We hope that it is unconfirmed, but we have to doubt it, that the President of the United States has been the victim of an assassination.
This is a sad time for all people. We have suffered a loss that cannot be waived. For me, it is a deep personal tragedy. I know that the world shares the sorrow that Mrs. Kennedy and her family bear. I will do my best. That is all I can do. I ask for your help. And God's.
Against the wall. These
people have given me a hearing without legal representation or anything.
Did you shoot the President?
I didn't shoot anybody, no, sir.
There is Lee Oswald. He's been shot. Lee Oswald has been shot. There's a man with a gun. It's absolute panic. Absolute panic here in the basement of Dallas Police Headquarters. Detectives have their guns drawn. Oswald has been shot.
no question about it. Oswald has been shot. Pandemonium has broken loose here in the basement of Dallas Police Headquarters.
Present!
This mass has been offered for John Fitzgerald Kennedy, 35th President of the United States. May he rest in peace.
Assassin's bullet has thrust upon me the awesome burden of the presidency. I am here today to say I need your help. I cannot bear this burden alone. I need the help of all Americans in all America.
The new president, with devotion and dedication to the Kennedy program, took as his number one mandate the passage of a federal civil rights bill.
I urge you again, as I did in 1957, and again in 1960, to enact a civil rights law so that we can move forward to eliminate from this nation every trace of discrimination and oppression that is based upon race or color.
The bill was passed in July 1964. Now, this presidential year, it was time. No one was surprised by this announcement from the popular and handsome Republican senator from Arizona.
I want to tell you that I will seek the Republican presidential nomination. And I have decided to do this because of the principles.
Barry Goldwater shook off a challenge by Nelson Rockefeller in the California primary and swept on to victory at the convention in San Francisco. His acceptance speech contained this key to his campaign.
I would remind you that extremism in the defense of liberty is no vice. And let me remind you also that moderation in the pursuit of justice is no virtue.
At the Democratic Convention in Atlantic City, Lyndon Johnson accepted the nomination with these words.
Our problems are many and are great.
but our opportunities are even greater. And let me make this clear. I ask the American people for a mandate not to preside over a finished program, not just to keep things going. I ask the American people for a mandate to begin.
Johnson was swept into office in a landslide reminiscent of the early FDR days. He had his mandate and a fair parcel of troubles. The civil rights problem had developed new urgency.
We've waited 100 years, and we are not waiting another day. We want all of it now! We want every privilege. We want every benefit. We want every right. We want every opportunity, and we want it now!
The civil rights movement split into moderates and black power extremists. There was a counter-reaction, a so-called white backlash that no one has been able to truly measure. The depressed Negro area of Los Angeles, the Watts section, broke into a flaming 4 days of riots. A patchwork of incidents continues to dot this period of change.
I saw New York's night of Birmingham horror. But now, brothers and sisters, let us get together, unite, plan a program of activity, and a program, and we'll win.
Since 1963, U.S. aid to the South Vietnamese in their guerrilla war with the Viet Cong communists had been growing rapidly. To highlight his profound concern, Pope Paul VI made an extraordinary flight to U.N. headquarters, a pilgrimage of peace. It was the first time in history a reigning pope had visited the New World. That night there was a mass for peace at Yankee Stadium. I sat awed at my post in an upper box at the spectacle. 90,000 of the faithful gathered in devotion.
Brothers and sons, we greet you and we bless you. What are we to say to you that can correspond to the duties of our apostolic ministry and be adequate to the spirit of this unique occasion? You must love peace. Here we can use the words of Christ. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the sons of God.
Still, the war goes on. Into this turbulent year of 1966, with conflicting rumors of peace feelers in mediation offers, reports of Chinese weakness coupled with the threatening reality of a successful atom missile test by Red China. In late October, President Johnson toured the Pacific and then rallied his allies with a conference at Manila. Back in his own capital of Saigon, South Vietnamese Premier Nguyen Cao Ky appraised that conference.
Yes, I think Gen. Calvin Vinh, the Chief of General Staff, and Gen. Westmoreland, Commander of the Allied Forces in Vietnam, at Manila, had gave a briefing about the military situation. And all the heads of government agree that the military situation now in South Vietnam is much, much better than last year. The most important thing comes out from this conference is unity of thinking and unity of action. So I'm sure with our determination, if we stand firm, and then the communists will change their mind.
We pause and wonder, trying to appraise the spirited hopes of this brisk leader of this Asian land. And there our adventurous recollections of the past third of a century come to an end before the blank pages of the future. What will the final third of our century bring? Certainly extraordinary advances in medicine, communications, and art. Perhaps excursions to other planets and the revelation of the true nature of flying objects. More events to challenge and fulfill the inexhaustible human spirit which has flowed so richly through the 33 years we've been recording. More of these fabulous years.